Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello and welcome. Our guests in the Salon today are Pedro de Sena and Caridad Switch, thinkers, makers and writers of and for performance, who share an interest in multilingual dramaturgies and polyphonic theatre. Pedro de Sena is a theatre practitioner and academic. He is a senior lecturer in contemporary theatre theory and practice at Middlesex University, where his current research focuses on the relationships between future studies and performance studies, theatre education and society, and performance and right-wing politics. He has published on theatre translation and adaptation, directing and dramaturgy, and disability aesthetics. In his practice, Pedro has extensive experience as a director, workshop facilitator, performer, and dramaturg. He is an associate director with Sign Dance Collective, a disabled-led dance theatre company using sign languages as a basis for their choreographic practice. Caridad Switch is a playwright and theatre maker. She received the 2012 OB for Lifetime Achievement Award and has been a visiting research fellow at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, University of London. Her plays in English and Spanish focus on human and environmental rights, gender fluidity, incantatory speech acts, and hybridity from a Latinx feminist perspective. She's published by Intellect UK, Matthew and Drama, and TCG, among others. Her most recent book is on Mitchell and Trask's Hedwig and the Angry Itch with Routledge 2019. Her first independent feature film, Fugitive Dreams, based on her play, has been selected for the 2020 Fantasia International Film Festival in Montreal. In 2015, Caridad and Pedro collaborated on Sign Dance Collective's production of Caridad's performance text Carthage, Cartagena, a piece exploring the condition of those displaced and isolated by slavery, human trafficking, and forced migration through 10 multilingual letter song poems from metaphorical places of dislocation. In this conversation, they discuss the relation between the deeply personal and intimate and the global and planetary in dramaturgical practices, always poised between a moment of listening and a moment of speaking. This conversation was recorded on Zoom between London and New York on the 6th of July, 2020.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Pedro, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
I wanted to start with a quote, actually, which I'm sure you know. I was reading this morning and I was like, oh, I love this quote. It's from Pratice Pravis from his book on sound and theater and performance. And he says, we spend our lives faced with images. They stand in our way. They guide us and they absorb us. But we live inside the world of sound. It encompasses us and mothers us. So I wanted to use that to kick us off.
Okay. I like this idea of sound encompassing us. I mean, we're now wearing headphones as we speak. And there is a sense that images tend to be outside us, but the sound is inside our heads, isn't it? We hear these voices and these things. And I think sound can be very, very intimate. And in that respect, extremely personal as well. Mm-hmm. In performance terms, I think there's also something interesting that sound does, which I guess there's an alienation that you might get with images as well, but that phenomenon that we all experience, that our voices don't sound the same in our heads as they do when we hear them back to us. So I think sound is very powerful in playing these dynamics between the self and the representation, the self and the portrayal of the self, or the presentation, the broadcast of the self. And that to me is fascinating as well. And I think every child has always been fascinated by this, by how we sound very different, you know, from in our heads.
I guess it makes me think about some relationship to performance specifically, or the act of making theater. Several things. One is that at this time, globally, when theater is, the idea of live theater is not a possibility, pretty much, except mm-hmm. for various isolated cases. I've been looking at how what seems to resonate, and the irony of that word, but what seems to resonate for me when I'm watching digital theater, Zoom stage theater like this, is that I've been seeing a lot of people experiment with like digital backdrops and like fancy design and like getting excited about all the gadgets and toys that are possible. But actually, mm-hmm. the work that I've seen that really moves me is work that is sophisticated around its use of sound. that actually, in a platform like this one, what I'm drawn to is what comes through the ear, but also what makes me reawaken to the sound of the everyday environment. And I think that in a theater space, usually, you know, I'm always fascinated by the idea of when I talk to sound designers about, you know, we're scoring the show and the text is already a score and we're laying another score on top of it. That's sort of counterpoint to that text or commenting on it in some way. But actually what we tend to not discuss so much is that there is a sound of the people when the people are there, of the people seeing the thing and the kind of sonic vibrations that they're bringing to the event. They're also the acoustics of the hall that you're in. If you're in an indoor space, you're in an outdoor space, that changes, right? So there's actually already a sonic bed that is in relationship to what is the staged sonic bed that's been created for us, right? From the theater event and from the designers sort of working on it. And so I've become reinterested in this notion of how we reawaken ourselves to understanding that if sound is encompassing us and mothering us, to use Patrice's phrase, that how we kind of negotiate that when we go to the theater or when we're in the presence of theater, even if it's digital, to reawaken that for ourselves. And it brings me back to the notion of course, our relationship to silence, which is part of the sonic bed. How do we sit with silence? What does silence mean in a digital space? Because sometimes it means that people get anxious, right? It's like silence, mm-hmm. oh no, that's dead space, but it's actually not dead space at all, right? So I think those are things that have been hovering a lot for me right now. Also related to, I know one of the things that we talked about prior to like talking today was the idea of like breath, right? And how breath sort of functions theatrically, but also as a necessity, yeah?
Gosh, there's so much to unpick in what you said. Okay, where do we begin?
I think I'm obsessed reaction, with sound, you know?
My first reaction when you started talking about sound in digital theaters was I remembered Thomas Ostermeyer's Richard III and the use of microphones there and
how
incredible that was. And it was so,
oh my God,
that really created that sort of environment. And then you moved on to talking about the bed of sound that is in a theater. And I was thinking, yeah, I've played to empty theaters before, and it sounds as an actor performing to an empty theater. It feels very different. And in this COVID times, if we do reopen the theaters at 30% capacity, that will change the nature, not only of the atmosphere and the environment, but actually sonically and acoustically, you know, how we'll be playing. And then what did you say? You moved on to, before you spoke about breath, you spoke about something else, and I should be making a note of this, but I wasn't.
I did speak about how we couldn't, I think, ignore sometimes, I think as makers actually, that
yes,
every time we're staging an event and we've spent hours in a rehearsal room and hours thinking of in design meetings and all those things that happen behind the scenes, basically mm-hmm. private facing events, right? When we go public facing, it's kind of like this thing that happens in relationship to an audience. But actually, what sometimes doesn't happen in the rehearsal hall is and I'm not saying that everybody, I think some people do think about this, but we don't think about necessarily at the act of making the thing, how that's going to resonate in the space. And actually, what is the sonic field that's going to enter that space, that's going to affect the space? By people, but also by the venue that you're in, and also what the history of that venue is, because mm-hmm. I believe in kind of ghosts, but I think that the idea of like the haunted breath that is inside a theater space, the haunted breaths that have been inside that theater space actually still affect how you walk into that, especially if it's a building.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that probably won't work its way towards our conversation a little later, but the idea of interference as well.
Yes.
From the sweet wrapper to the mobile phone, sort of. I remember once being in Epidaurus watching Antigone in a famous for its acoustics.
Yes.
This beautiful theater, 14,000 people sitting and watching the National Theater of Greece playing Antigone. And then somebody's mobile phone rings in the middle of that sort of environment. And you just want for there to be a kind of a spotlight right on that person and be sucked out of the theater, you know. So it's interesting how a sound disruption, a sound disturbance can also completely remove you. Going back to Pavie, this idea that sound envelops you, but sound also is capable of completely taking you away.
Right.
Another example of this, sort of similarly, again in Greece, it's at an open air theater. We're about to watch Iphigenia in Aulis. And it was an open air theater inside of a city in Thessaloniki in northern Greece. This relates a little bit to the notion of breath. And I have to kind of open brackets here, perhaps. Something that always fascinated me was that moment of silence between the conductor lifting their baton and the orchestra starting to play, that intake of breath before it starts. And that's, I think, a really, really pregnant silence, a moment of anticipation of sound about to come. So the theater equivalent of that is perhaps when the lights go off and the show's about to start. And so, closing brackets now, we were at this moment in Thessaloniki, in this open air theater, lots of people coming in, milling around and so on. And then the lights went dark and a car alarm went on in the neighborhood as the opening line of the show was about to be uttered. Luckily, the stage manager had the presence of spirit to wait for the car alarm to stop before they cued the lights on and the show could start. But again, the kind of sound interfering and completely, and you know, we all held our breath as the lights went off, you know, okay, it's about to start. And then, you know, and then there was that sort of break, which we needed to kind of retune ourselves to the space and to the environment, which I think is fascinating, really.
Yeah, but sometimes I find that I've been going back and forth on this notion of interference and maybe what we think of about as noise, for example, or disruptive noise, because I always think there's noise in a space in a good way. I've been going back and forth on it because I feel like maybe more recently I've just been thinking a lot about the policing of theater spaces and
of audiences,
sonically, and also the fact that sometimes somebody's mobile does go off and we just wait and let it happen and move on. You know what I mean? Like, we're all in the same space together. So I don't understand the need to not acknowledge that. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels a little bit strange to go, there's an event happening. It's live. If we're doing live theater, you're there. Oops, something happened. We actually could stop. If we're on stage, you know, we can actually totally stop and like just wait for that thing to occur, you know, and
acknowledge,
because we never know if it's like an accident. We don't know if it's like an emergency. We don't know, you know what I mean? And I just feel like sometimes I feel a little bit that the policing of theater spaces around sound and specifically around response, for example. I know Christy Sedgman has written about this in Reasonable Audience a great deal, but sort of looking at be quiet, yeah. Let the show, you know, don't respond, you know, but actually sometimes you have to. And I remember I saw, speaking of the Greeks or Greek-like things, there was a very intense, incredibly physical sort of Pina Bausch-influenced production of Julius Caesar, out of all places, Oregon Shakespeare, which is not particularly known for, I wouldn't say like massively avant-garde productions, but this production was, you know, pretty much sort of in that spectrum. And it was incredibly violent in a way that was visceral and exciting and thrilling. And it made me, I mean, I had no, my caveat was I went into that production and I was like, I have no interest in seeing Julius Caesar again. Like, I'm so bored by this play. But then I was sort of awakened by the theater experience and how this director, Shana Cooper, sort of staged it. And the person sitting next to me was kind of like, oh my God. Oh. She was always emoting, right? In terms of what's happening, because she was reacting to the work. Like, it was so, like, it was in her bones, right? And so the person in front of us turned around, shut up. Quite loudly.
Gosh.
You know, the actors are doing their, I'm in the audience. The actors are still acting and doing their thing. The thing is still happening. And I was like, has anybody acknowledged that this just occurred? You know, and then in the interval, they actually got into an altercation about, she was like, I am responding as I respond. And he was like, you shouldn't be responding when you go to the theater. You should be quiet. I left that row as an audience member. I left and I went to the back of the theater to watch the rest of the show, where there was actually no one, so that I could concentrate on the show. Because suddenly there was so much, I felt like there was so much active, disruptive noise in my row that I actually felt like I couldn't re-engage with the piece after intermission if I didn't leave the physical space of that row that I was in.
And there's something about the production of sound that is in communion, if you like, with the show, as you're saying. And in that sense, the shut up is a lot more disruptive and breaks the than the actual breathing along with it. So it's interesting.
Which I guess sends really me back to this notion of, like, that I think of, and I'm not the only one who thinks it, but I often, when I specifically talk to students or myself, if I'm talking to myself about writing plays or making theater pieces, is that I always say it's a breathing apparatus that you're making. It's how that piece breathes through space and time, but it's also, hence the score, but also how the audience, how you're structuring how the audience, how you imagine the audience will breathe through that piece, through space and time eventually. And I find, like, structuring the breathing of a piece as it moves dramaturgically is really key for me, like, to the notion of, like, do we want the audience to be like, do we want them to be like, I'm just going to zone out for a little bit and I'm just going to be with you for a while. Do we want them in that place of the anticipatory, right? That thing of, like, the inhale of, like, it's about to start or this moment's about to happen, which happens sometimes when you're structuring.
Yeah, and it gets that with classics as well, doesn't it? You know, if you go see a Shakespeare and Henry V is about to start his big,
speech.
You know, everybody kind of, like, holds on, okay, it's coming. You know, there's that sort of thing that everybody wants to kind of, it holds their breath together. And this common exhalation is fascinating as well. I think it's interesting because we're kind of, in our conversation, we are already talking to our chosen sounds, even though we haven't played them yet, because
we're
talking about the environment, and we're talking about breath, and we're talking about breath, which might be disrupted somehow. So I wonder if it might be a good time for me to play the sound of that breath for you.
Yes,
given that, I think some of the words that we've already used are all very much of today. We talked about, maybe we didn't use the word lockdown, but we talked about our conditions of these kind of situations, having to use digital theater. And we use the word policing, and we know the relationship between police and people breathing or not these days is one that is very fraught as well. And of course, the idea of the lockdown and what it has done to the planet in some ways. You know, I can hear more birds in my garden, and I can I can hear different, you know, the soundscape around me and the environment has changed as well. So I'll play this clip, and it's a clip of breathing of someone with advanced pneumonia heard from a stethoscope. It's something akin to what you would hear, or a doctor would hear, if they were listening to somebody with COVID-19. Because the sound is really layered. It's about 45 seconds or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty haunting as well.
Yeah.
I don't know what your reactions to it are. Yeah, maybe you could tell me in that.
Yeah, I feel like it's funny that, like, the first word that popped to my mind was combination of sort of antithetical words. One was soothing, strangely soothing, but also it felt like invasive, like I was privy to something I shouldn't be privy to. Yeah, so it felt like, should I be? What right do I have to be listening to? to the sound of this person with pneumonia. Do you know what I mean? Like, I suddenly was like, I'm not the doctor. Like, so it suddenly displaced from its context. It's totally fascinating as a sound sample. But it then, you know, if I had it, like, since you gave me the context, I'm like, is this right? Like, should I be? You know, I think it puts me in this space of trying to negotiate as a receptor of the sound. Two things. One is the soothing part of it is that could also be my body, right? Like, that could, you know, like, how do we listen to our own bodies if we could, if we had sort of the instruments to do so, and what would they sound like? Oh my gosh. And the second part of that is that other part of, like, negotiating, am I the appropriate receiver of this? And if so, how do I reintegrate it to the body from which it came, so that it is restored, so that it is kind of like acknowledging the presence of the human to which this belonged. So yeah, so that's where I rest with it, actually.
That's very interesting. Because in a way, I mean, when you said about it, you know, there's this sense of us kind of wondering whether we should be listening to this or whether we should be watching to this. I think sometimes good theater does this to you, you know? And should I be, you know, should I be witness to this? What right, you know, do I have
right.
to witness this?
Right.
And good dramaturgy does that as well. I think what attracted me to this, and maybe why I find it haunting as well as more haunting than soothing, so I guess I had been thinking about the notion of breath, as you know, for some time. And I was kind of trailing through a bunch of sort of clips of breathing and what would be considered sort of healthy, normal breathing. And then there was this breathing with pneumonia and the explanation. And you start being able to kind of unpick the various layers, that there is a kind of a rumbling in the background that is there. And I can't remember another medical term for that particular type of rumbling. And then you have another sort of sound of crackling, as well as the in and out sort of breath, that in regular breathing you wouldn't get. And so it's almost as if the disease adds complexity to the breath, sonically at
right.
least.
Yes. Yeah.
And I totally get you that there is an ethical kind of dimension to this. Like, you know, who is this poor person? Do they get better? You know, so like, do I
they get better? Who are they? Are they gonna be all right? Oh my God.
And understanding how the disruption manifests itself sonically and actually makes it interesting to hear, which takes me a little bit to the idea of disability aesthetics and the idea of things that are quote unquote broken, that are actually aesthetically more interesting and attractive to us. And I don't know if this is at the essence of drama, isn't it? I mean, I remember you tweeted once that you can write happy plays.
I can occasionally, and I do. But then, you know, it doesn't happen. It has to happen. I think sometimes I have to tell myself that's what I want to do. I guess it's sort of riffing off of what you're describing, but I also think about the notion of what's the container for that breath, and that when we're making theater, we're I think as makers, I think, constantly thinking about what the container is, and is this the right container for this material, or for these objects that I'm putting in this space, or for this relationship with the audience, and is it an ethical relationship? But it also makes me think about orientation and disorientation, right? Which sound is chiefly part of. Weirdly, it reminded me of a visual metaphor theatrically, which is the theater maker John Jessering in his staging of Philoctetes, his version of Philoctetes, because he designs his work as well as directs it and does everything. When I saw his production, he had the sort of projected screen behind the actors for the first maybe 10 minutes of the show was just a series of what looked like moving cloud formations, like it felt very innocuous. It was blurry and it was like, oh, cloud formation, like interesting cloud formations. And occasionally there'd be like something that looked like we could have deciphered what it was, but it was like a particle or something, a breath particle, we thought maybe. And then as the play moved forward, it got less blurry. And they were like bullet casings.
Oh, wow.
They had film. Yeah. So, and suddenly it reoriented us to what we were just seeing, or we thought we were seeing. And I think sound functions similarly, that we are conditioned to, we're oriented towards something, we're literally oriented, like we're sort of brought into something sonically as listeners or as receptors of sound in our bodies. And then I think in theater, we're trying to constantly disorient, you know, once we create the orientation, to disorient through that sonically as a dramaturgical tool. And sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it hits us over the head. Or sometimes it's playful, like I think of course, you know, of Complicitates, the encounter and its use of binaural headphone technology and how it sort of constantly displaces where we think the sound is coming from, and including the notion of lip sync and how it reawakens us to the idea that, oh, actually, that's not a live voice that I'm hearing. I'm hearing somebody speaking to a pre-recording, but the illusion that it's live, you know, in the moment, and the kind of the privileging or an accustomed orientation around, oh, if I'm seeing live theater, everybody's live, when in fact, maybe they're not part of the time, you know? So, and that's something that I'm really fascinated by, this notion of like how in lip sync can be an interesting tool to actually also disorient an audience toward the presence of a performer, toward their vocal presence, but also their bodily presence and their corporeal sonic, their own corporeal sonic beds. But also like that pre-recording is them at another time. So it's not them in the moment, but it's them maybe like 3 weeks ago when they recorded the thing. And so we're getting almost what I call kind of a time-lapse effect. Like that's a pre-recording of that performer 3 weeks ago that I'm now hearing live in the space, decontextualized. And so it just makes me think about that, which might be a good segue for my clip, weirdly, very in a weird way. But I know you have that at the ready, so I won't say what it is. I'll say what it is after.
Okay. So I'll play it.
Shelf in Antarctica. I recorded. I have 33 seconds of that. I'll preface that by saying that I've been working on a piece about Antarctica, partly about Antarctica and partly about Ushuaia in Argentina for a while. And one of my ways into it as a writer, after doing a lot of research and I actually interviewed a scientist for it and all this stuff, was actually I really wanted to listen to the sound of the ice. I was like, I want to feel. The scientist kept talking about, you know, his own photography of Antarctica and his own research there. And it's like, oh, the glaciers and this, that. And I was like, I just want to listen to the ice. Can I just listen to the ice, please? Because I think that that's actually the music of the earth, right? So I wanted to go back to this idea of our reconnection to the planet and how sound can be one of those reconnections. I mean, it is. It's always around us and it's always inside of us, but it's also like a way of deep listening to the earth, especially at a time when matters around climate grief and climate change are prominent. Yeah, so hence and thinking about how do we listen to the ice and what does that mean when we hear it. So I'm curious about your reaction.
I mean, lots of things. I think that this idea of deep listening, again, both our clips actually come from recordings that require special equipment and not just,
Right.
And there's something about the background sort of rumble in that almost echoes the background rumble of the lung. And I mean, I don't know the full science behind the ice shelf, but I wonder if that background also has something to do with the disintegration of that of the ice shelf, as you were saying, you know, how mm-hmm. saw a clip or read something about how scientists are using the sound also as a way to measure changes in the structure of the ice from climate change. So it's almost, again, like everything is coming together, isn't it? It's this breathing of the earth and our own personal breathing and the very intimate and the global kind of coming together. And again, I think the best theater does, and as I think your theater often does. Earlier, you were speaking about the sound interference sort of hitting you on the head. And I think that the example of this clip has this thing that you have this background and suddenly you have this sort of jarring sort of thing coming in. And it's incredibly dramatic. And I think, again, to me, it's a bit like the presence of a foreign language in a play, which is something that, you know, you and I have worked together on quite a lot.
Quite a lot indeed. Yeah, and I think that, you know, I've been thinking sometimes just the act of, especially in an English, we both live, I'm in the United States and you're in the UK, and it's no surprise, but in some ways it is, weirdly, we're both in English language dominant societies, where English is privileged as the language of theater, you know, as the spoken language of theater, but also the structural language of the kind of theater. A lot of kind of theater gets made coming from kind of Western Eurocentric sources. And I think that because of that, every time I hear or a play displaces that, even if it's just for a moment, I'm like, ooh, thank you. thank you for reminding us that we're in a multilingual world.
Então você acha que a gente devia falar português daqui para frente? De repente é melhor a gente. Eu falo pouco de português e você fala pouco de espanhol, não?
Precisamente.
Precisamente, sim, verdade.
Precisamente. No, it's just like funny, you know, and I kept thinking about I re-looked at A Tempest in Our Life, which I know is like a play that some people have problems with, but Attendance in Our Life by Martin Crimm. But I had forgotten, because I was teaching it this semester, and I've forgotten that last sequence where the translations occur. So it's like, Linus said this translation, and this translation, and this translation. It's like, oh my God, that's so exciting. Like, and then it was interesting, because reading it, I was like, when's the last time? I can't think of the last time I've seen work that actually does that. Do you know what I mean? Like outside of seeing, you know, work with Stuart Treidels and going to BAM or going to St. Anne's Warehouse or, you know, whatever. And it's like, oh, I ache for just an acknowledgement that, you know, as simple as gesture as that toward, there are other languages, they sound differently. It's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I've found a lot with, I think, more parochial or provincial audiences, I would say, is that I've been in talkbacks where, oh my gosh, I had like Spanish in one of my, you know, I write in Spanish sometimes, and sometimes I write in Spanglish, and sometimes whatever, you know. And I think I had Spanglish in my play, one of my plays, and audience member of the talkback was like, but I don't understand. like literally, I think I had like maybe throughout the whole play, maybe five sentences in Spanish, you know, for real. Mm. Why? I had to suddenly for a moment, like retune my ear to something else. And why didn't you immediately translate it when the line was said? It's like, I'm not going to do that for you. No. Well, but I think the resistance to listening, to actually listening to a different kind of, and yet we live in countries, but also live in cities. They're deeply multilingual. Now you go down the street and you're hearing different kinds of languages on the street.
Yes. But I mean, this anecdote that you just told sort of tells us a lot about not only, I think, hierarchies of language, but hierarchies of listening. That's not exactly what I want to say. I think what I want to say is that there are these hierarchies of modes of perception, almost of aesthetic choices that audiences, that there is, as you said, there is one way of watching theater, and that if this way of watching theater is somehow disrupted, that people feel somehow disempowered or the ground shifts beneath them. And again, I wonder if the act of writing is, and this was once said about something I wrote, that the play was trying to teach the audience a new way to listen. And so how much listening is involved in writing, and how much does writing and dramaturgy affect the way we listen? I would like to try and link back, I might not be making any sense, but hey, I'd like to try to link this back to what you said as you introduced your sound, that you said, I didn't want just to look at the glaciers or the ice sheets, I wanted to listen to it. So how does that listening feed into your writing, I guess, is what I wanted to ask.
Yeah, I mean, I think on a more conceptual level, that particular project was a commission, so there were some parameters to it that I had to adhere to. But on a more conceptual level, liberated from the specifics of that project, one of the things I'm deeply interested in around dramaturgy, and I think, you know, it's interesting in Spanish, dramaturgo is the word for playwright. And it's funny because when I meet writers, especially from Latin America and Spain and so forth, the notion of the word, there isn't an equivalent of the word playwright necessarily, right, in the same way that we use it. So I go back to the idea of dramaturgo. So the idea of dramaturgy, scoring a text, I'm constantly thinking about not just line breaks and where the breath is held, where the breath is released, but sometimes going to a place that seems impossible. I'm really interested in listening to conditioned listening around specifically, let's say, plays, just to put that on the table. Plays that may look like plays to some degree, that have characters and action, all those things, and maybe about people in rooms. Although I think it's always in a room, it's the room of theater. Anyway, so looking at that just specifically, after you're scoring a text, there are ways that you want to play with the audience. One of them is, do I lift them into the play? Do I invite them and orient them sonically into the experience of this play by a sound that feels familiar, right? So you're like, oh, is it set up like the rhythms of Sekhom? I studied, you know, I think this is something people don't know, but now they're going to know because they listen to the podcast. But I actually studied comedy a lot. And in fact, in my early formative years as a playwright, I was obsessed with comedy and the structures of comedic routines and how they operate on the ear. And I think that's affected all of my work. That and kind of my interest in study of music. So I think within that is the idea you're orienting an audience to a sound that may be familiar. Your job part of the way is to disorient them from the familiar to something new. Once you've done that, you have to disorient them again, because as soon as they hear it, they'll be reoriented and think that's familiar. Do you know what I mean? And so I think I'm constantly trying to play a game with having the receiver not only try to hear new sounds, as it were, which is hard to do in a kind of culture that is constantly recycling older sounds. So how do you listen to that in you? And secondly, around moments of impossibility. So what on the page might be, for some people, unreadability, or for me, more crucially, around breath control and actually going past the point, like sometimes creating passages in my text, like planes of text where I'm asking the performer to actually go beyond what may seem possible, so that they're kind of like having to really hold a lot of breath to get through the thing. I'm fascinated by that, but I know that sometimes on a more plebeian sense, when I'm working or when I'm discussing dramaturgy with students or with other colleagues, that notion kind of isn't talked about very much, that actually as a scorer of text, theater makers, one of our jobs is to play with the, again, the breathing apparatus. What is the breathing apparatus of the piece, but also in individual moments, how you're calibrating that breathing apparatus. And sometimes you want to extend it, kind of have the lungs do a lot of work, and sometimes you want them to kind of like feel like there's very little work happening, and maybe it's just one word being thrown and another word being thrown, or maybe just an utterance, or maybe a cry, or maybe a stomp, or maybe a gesture that is also vibrating sonically. And so I think that that's what I think about to, respond, to your question.
actors consciously train to breathe. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, and I don't think there is much in sort of when you're training playwrights, that sort of this kind of education about breathing in writing plays. Yeah. But that's kind of interesting to think of, you know, if we're teaching and training or educating people who are writing and educating dramaturgs, how much attention is paid to breath and to listening. And I wanted to come back to this again, to this idea of listening on a planetary scale. Yeah. I think we could talk about listening to voices and to languages and so on, but listening to the earth as well, as you were talking about, and how much of that works its way into, I guess what I'm trying to articulate is that, and perhaps I never had before, is really that first and foremost, writing is about listening.
Yeah.
And dramaturgy is about that, isn't it? Is it whether this is the rhythm of one's breath, the potential disruption to that, or the rhythm of life around you, from a planetary perspective, I think this is quite important and quite political, that this listening is done properly. We're also at a place politically now where so many people are being finally made to and required to actively listen to others.
Right.
So I don't know if we can maybe turn this final kind of bit of our conversation, turn it a bit more political and talk about this kind of political listening, whether it's echo listening or Black Lives Matter listening or or intersectional, all these three things listening, because I don't think you can separate gender equality from racial equality, from planetary and eco equality and eco solidarity. So
yeah, but I think crucially around class, because environmental racism is at the root of a lot of the of what we call climate change. And in terms of climate change, most of that is human made, yes, but it's also human made predominantly white human made climate change against Black and brown communities around the globe, extracting resources from their land, extracting labor, creating toxic zones of life in their immediate environment. So we're talking about environment. And it's funny because I was talking to a colleague last week. We were talking about ecodrama. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And I said, no, it's not a niche subject. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think what bothers me when people use the word ecodrama is that it becomes you study it in a course somewhere or it lives in an anthology, but actually everything we do when we make art, and specifically theater, because we're theater makers, has to be eco-conscious, you know, because we're responding to it. We're in response to our environment, right? So, and to ignore that feels, A, it's a fallacy. B, it, what kind of power systems is it playing into and value systems are playing into? Therefore, if you are deliberately ignoring in the making of the work, the larger ecosystems of which you are a part, related to that, the idea of, which I'm partially obsessed with, this idea of vocal hygiene, which has to do with policing the voice, policing the mouth, policing what can be uttered, mm-hmm. retroactively from that in terms of Black Lives Matter, but also we talked about listening, and I'd say what I'm seeing a lot of right now is faux listening, you know, okay. Like check mark. Yes, you know, I'll post something, I'm listening, as opposed to actually maybe not check mark, let me post something, I'm listening, but more, let me just absorb. I think part of the act of listening is actually sitting with and being with something. And it's actually the being with that gets you to a place that's uncomfortable, because you can't actually check, did that sort of attitude. Check, did that. We have our diversity inclusion initiative.
as opposed to actually
really living with that and the ramifications.
How do we as artists and makers then sit with this? Because in some way, we speak through our art. We speak through our theater making. And therefore, I guess I'm trying to kind of square this, not necessarily contradiction, but the opposition between this moment of listening and this moment of speaking that comes from the dramaturgy or the work that we make.
Yes.
I think it's something that needs to be, I guess we need to take time. Maybe we should write, I mean, I'm saying this to a playwright, we should write fewer plays.
That's and not talk so much. Because I'm so prolific, but but I think it's like taking time. I think being with, I like the using the phrase being with. How can we be with material? How can we be with what's happening in society, which globally is exceptionally profound at the moment. It also has been historically profound at different times. So maybe it's looking, reading about what's happened historically in the past. It also may mean making different kinds of things, you know, if we're making, so maybe it's a podcast like this or an audio piece, or I've been attracted, again, like I said, to also things that are sort of functioning via audio much more, I think, because it's funny, they kind of like, they live in your everyday life in a different way. You know what I mean? I can listen to an audio piece, an audio drama, as I am also doing things in my environment. And I love the coexistence of that. And I think that sometimes theater, in a more conventional sense, you go to a building or you go to a site where something is, a performance is being held, and the notion of holding a performance is such an interesting phrase. It's not living with you exactly in the same way as you're like, I'm going through my life and there's theater in my ear at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's relating to how I'm moving through my life, which means maybe relating to how I am seeing someone else on the street, how I'm acknowledging a Twitter post. How I'm, you know, I think those all are in concert with each other. And I think that sometimes in plays and maybe plays that are being asked to be hierarchical in how they present their content, as opposed to, and vertical, as opposed to horizontal in how they present their content, ask audiences sometimes to not really listen, actually, to pretend they're listening to something. So that way, can they walk out? They're like, I listened. Mm-hmm. I carry on with my day, as opposed to, oh, I listened. Whoa, I don't know what just happened, but I think I listened to something. I think I heard something. And how do we hear? And how do we hear through the eye? How do we hear through the ear? How do we hear through our bodies corporeally? How does it affect our skin? I think that that's stuff that I think about a lot, and related to the idea of amplification. Both like on a sonic level, like how do we amplify, but also, and I love how that word is used so much now, much more, like outside of like the world of sound design, but like, we'll amplify you, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm like, well, actually, maybe de-amplify for a while would be awesome. how can we take some steps back to actually think about what amplification means, which is related to, you know, one of the first things you said when we started talking, which is the idea of broadcasting, right? So how do we broadcast, but at the same time, not broadcast. I mean, I think I'm interested in the idea of negation, right? So the idea of like, how do we like be in a space of amplification, which is a theater space, but also be in a place where we're not amplifying or re-ascribing through amplification existing modes, which requires deep listening in order to not re-amplify those modes, right? So it's like a very complicated web.
Listening to the rumbles in the breath, really, isn't it? It's kind of
listening to the rumbles, yeah.
Finding the, or as Bard would have it, the grain in the voice, you know.
Absolutely, yes.
And I think that's what we ought to do. I mean, obviously, I mean, one thing we didn't touch upon, and I fear we won't have time to, but it's also, you know, the absence of sound or the difficulty, yes, if people are hard of hearing, for example, and how does that sort of, as you know, I work with sign language sometimes, and it's interesting to think about these other ways of listening, which are not necessarily aural, But as you say, they have to do with this deep listening that go beyond the sonic and how they might teach us perhaps something about different qualities of listening. I fear we don't have much time.
So sorry. I mean, I think the one thing I will say is that in relationship to that, I've only just started reading about it, so I don't have all the stuff at the ready, but I was reading an article around sound design and looking at actually work made for and by deaf and hard of hearing artists, and looking at how, what was the word? I think it was intertone or intratone. There's something like a tone that's below the frequency that most hearing folks are accustomed to listening things to, but actually there's a tone that's much lower part of hearing deaf people respond to in their bodies, and that sound designers are experimenting with for theatrical pieces of placing works at this kind of, and again, it's the word is like intertone or intratone, where
infratone maybe? I don't know.
Maybe infratone, maybe, where it's much, much lower, but actually it will connect with a harder hearing deaf audience somehow, because there's something in the vibration of that very, 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 very low frequency that actually connects through the body. I've just been fascinated by that, because I've also been thinking about like how can that be applied? So I think a lot in the world of sound design, but also thinking about when I've been writing, one of the pieces that I wrote recently has to do with, may seem unrelated, but there's a point. I'm exploring a lot of ASMR, so this notion of whisper right here. And I'm like, I'm fascinated by that as a theatrical device and a gesture, because it also makes an audience kind of go, what? But you're also playing very, very intimately, usually with a microphone when you're doing that. It actually does gets inside you in different ways. So the notion of intimacy gets recalibrated. So those are things I'm thinking about in response to what you're saying, but yeah. What should we end with? Which are two words or three words?
What should we end with?
A bold statement.
I think silence might be the answer.
Silence would be great. Yes, indeed. It was a pleasure, Pedro.
A pleasure. And I wish we could talk for hours and hours.
For hours and hours and hours.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Dusko Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Dano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Dusko Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.